Okay.
Okay, our next speaker is John Breskel, and he's going to talk about topology and quantum error correction.
Well, I'm excited to be here, since, like many of the people in the room, I've regarded Mike Friedman as one of my scientific heroes. And like others we heard this morning, I can document when Mike and I met. These are the doodles I made when we talked on the phone for the first time. This was in February of 1998. Jeff Kimball had suggested I call Mike because he knew we were both interested in topological quantum computing. And very uncharacteristically for me, I actually called him and we talked. And so the most significant part of the doodle is the part in the lower left when I decided I would go visit Friedman and drew a circle around it. And uncharacteristically for me, I actually went a week later and talked to Mike. And we had a very enjoyable and memorable discussion. And I learned that Mike actually had a dream for some years already at that time that we might be able to realize a topological quantum field theory in the lab, and that it would have remarkable capabilities if we could. He had just recently at that time published this paper which described a quite audacious version of that dream, and that was one of the things we talked about. But we also talked about this paper, of which I was a big admirer, so I was in the enviable position of being an ambassador from Alexei Kitaev to Mike regarding the idea of using anyons to protect quantum computations from decoherence. And Mike was very receptive to these ideas and zealously pursued them and developed them until in early 2000 he and his co-authors produced these two lovely papers. These papers established that the quantum circuit model and the topological model are really equivalent, that each can simulate the other efficiently. And like many physicists, I was a bit intimidated by a paper whose title began, A Modular Functor Witch, but I overcame my queasiness. And I understood these papers in the best way possible by teaching the content of them to my quantum computing class at Caltech, and by so doing, I was able to appreciate the accomplishment of Mike and co-authors. So I've been working for some years in this field that we call quantum information science, and sometimes people say, what is that? And I think one way of characterizing what we're trying to do is we're rebelling against the dichotomy that we learned in school, that microscopic things are quantum and macroscopic things are classical. In quantum information science, we are hoping to control complicated quantum systems. And one reason for doing so is that we believe that, in general, quantum systems can't be simulated efficiently by classical systems. So a quantum system, if we can control it, should be capable of performing tasks that we couldn't achieve with ordinary digital computers. And of course, if we're going to succeed in achieving large-scale quantum computing, we have to overcome this formidable enemy of decoherence. And one of the central fields, one of the central questions in this field is this problem just really, really hard so that if we work at it for a few decades, we'll eventually succeed? Or is it ridiculously hard so that we might never succeed? And I'm among those who believes that it's merely really, really hard. And what underlies that belief is kind of a delicious irony in this subject, which is that really it's the macroscopic world, which is quantum in a sense, that if we want to protect against decoherence, we really want to consider large systems which have collective properties which are highly quantum that we can control. And that notion I first learned from, it sprung from the fertile mind of Peter Shor, who in 1995 proposed quantum error correcting codes, and also Andy Seen at the same time. So the idea of the quantum error correcting code was, I want to protect a quantum system from damage. And so I actually encode it in a system with many degrees of freedom, let's say many qubits. there's a logical qubit that I want to be able to protect. So I use many physical qubits, and there are two states of the many physical qubits, which we can think of as the two basis states of a qubit, and we want, of the logical qubit, we want to protect that against noise operators that act on a small part of the system at a time. And in order for that to work, it must be that when these errors act, they don't spoil the distinguishability of the two states of the logical qubit, 0 and 1, and that's enough to protect classical information stored in the system. But it's quantum information, so we want something more. We want to protect against dephasing. So we also want the states in the dual basis, 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1, to remain distinguishable when the errors act on the system. And if both those conditions are satisfied, then it's actually possible, after the noise acts, to perform a recovery operation that undoes the damage caused by the noise. And these conditions imply that if we imagine measuring these error operators, they don't give us any information that distinguishes the logical zero from the logical one. They look the same locally. And that sounds a lot like the notion of topological order in quantum many-body systems. When we say there's topological order, we mean that we have a Hamiltonian, which has a ground state which is degenerate in the thermodynamic limit, such that when we look at distinct ground states with local operators, they look exactly the same. They can't be distinguished. So topological order is really a description, when we consider its ground states, of a quantum error-correcting code. So it's kind of natural that topology should arise in the context of trying to protect quantum systems. The topological properties of an object are the ones that remain unchanged if we smoothly deform the object. And if I'm performing a quantum computation, and I want to protect it from noise, then I want the way the computation acts on the protected information to remain invariant when I deform the computer by introducing some noise. So in some sense, I want to manipulate topological properties that are invariant under deformation. Now, Shor did another great thing the next year, which was to explain the principles of fault-tolerant quantum computing. We want to do more than just store quantum information reliably. We want to be able to process it and do a quantum computation that's protected against noise. And Shor pointed out that if you use some coding scheme, there may be some operations, some quantum gates that are easy to do acting on the encoded information, but not enough for computational universality, so you need some additional trick. And the trick, which was described in a more general way later by Gottesman and Chuang, is a kind of gate teleportation. Quantum teleportation is a way of moving quantum information from one data register to another. And we want to do gates on the information, so we want to do a kind of twisted teleportation where we prepare offline some quantum state, I'll call it quantum software, and then perform some kind of a collective measurement on the data that's coming in and the software in order to teleport the data to the output register, but with a twist, some encoded operation. But we want to make that reliable, so this software has to be prepared reliably, and we need some way of doing that, and that was a problem that Shor solved in this paper. But another way of doing it was described later by Bravi and Kataev, which can be used in a fairly general setting. We have some gates that we can do well on our encoded information, which aren't enough for universality, but they are enough to do something interesting to prepare good quantum software. If we can prepare noisy quantum software, there's a distillation protocol we can run that takes several noisy copies of the software as input and produces one good copy as output. So that was kind of a complicated story, but the point is that if I can do just a few things really well on the encoded information, I can boost from there to do reliable universal quantum computing. And that's been an important idea in subsequent work on fault-tolerant quantum computing. So it follows from these principles of fault tolerance that there's a quantum accuracy threshold theorem. What that means is that if the noise has nice properties, if it's sufficiently weak and not too strongly correlated, then if I want to do a long quantum computation, it's possible to do it accurately with some reasonable overhead cost in the number of qubits and the number of gates that have to be applied. So that result indicates that there is a path we can imagine, a a long, steep road we can climb to get to scalable quantum computing, and it gives us hope. And it raises a lot of questions. Some of them are practical questions. How can we actually get this stuff to work with reasonable resources in a real device? And there are questions of principle, too. What properties does the noise actually have to have for it to work? What kinds of schemes are scalable? What are the ingredients in a scalable scheme? And so on. Now, there are these two paradigms for how we might do scalable quantum computing, which we might call the software and the hardware paradigm, or the conventional paradigm and the topological one. So the software paradigm, that's kind of the standard approach. You take anybody's qubit, somebody has made good qubits, and then you use clever circuit design to fault-tolerantly simulate an ideal circuit. And you can apply that to any kind of hardware if the hardware is good enough. And the physical or hardware approach is to find some very clever encoding of the information in a physical system that's especially resistant to decoherence. But we shouldn't think of these two perspectives as being adversaries. They should be friends. They can be profitably combined. Topological quantum computing can have its effectiveness boosted if we combine it together with the software strategy. And also, topological ideas can provide inspiration about how to build good error-correcting codes and good fault-tolerant quantum computation schemes. So I want to give three examples of that, where there have been fruitful interactions between topological ideas and fault tolerance. Well, the first is topological codes. And we've already heard about this several times today. Kataev developed a topological quantum error-correcting code back in the 90s, the Toric code. And Kataev knew about the idea of topological order, and he was trying to build a code that captured that idea that could be used in any quantum computer. So one way of describing that perspective is we can imagine a two-dimensional system, a planar system. It has two types of particles, electric and magnetic excitations, which have Harnoff-Bohm interactions. And the system has edges. So there are two types of particles, red and green, which can appear and disappear at the green edges when they're green particles, or at the red edges where they're red particles. And so we can imagine an operation in which a green particle is created at one edge, propagates to the opposite edge, and disappears. It's a kind of string operator simulating the propagation of a particle across the sample. And similarly, we can consider a red string operator describing the propagation of a red particle across the sample. And then if we undo the green operation and undo the red operation, the sequence of operations, each one of it preserves the ground state. It takes the state with no particles to a state with no particles. But a non-trivial phase is acquired because the process I've described is equivalent to one in which the green particle winds around the red particle and there's a Harnoff-Bohm phase. So what that means is that since we have non-commuting operators that preserve the ground state can't be one-dimensional. It's a code. And it's that code space that we want to use to protect the quantum information. So we can consider using such a code in a two-dimensional system, and that's important. In the early work on quantum fault tolerance, we didn't worry so much about geometry. It was sometimes assumed that a quantum gate could act on any pair of qubits, no matter what the distance between the qubits, with some fixed fidelity. But if we really want to lay this out in a device, we'll have to do something like have a lattice of qubits in a presumably a two-dimensional array, and then with wires going off in the third dimension so that we can control the qubits from outside in some way. And probably there will be limitations on the geometric locality of the gate. So we can imagine that only neighboring qubits can interact with one another in a highly controlled way. But we can use topological codes in that setting. So the gray here just represents a sea of qubits, which are in the code, and the white, well, there might be qubits there too, but they're not in the code. And I can think of the encoded qubits as being described by, say, electric charges, which can either be present or absent in each one of the holes in the sample. And they're encoded operations like a green string operator that moves an electric charge from one hole to another, or a red string operator which corresponds to producing a pair of magnetic excitations winding around the hole and then letting the pair reannihilate. Now, when errors occur, we can think of the errors as producing pairs of particles or allowing particles to propagate from one site on this lattice to a neighboring site. But we can imagine continually making measurements so we know at all times where the particles are. Those measurements might not be perfect, but we keep repeating them so we have pretty reliable information about where the particles are. And if the errors are rare, then typically pairs of particles will be in close proximity to one another and distantly separated from other pairs. So if we're continually watching this gas of particles, at any time we can guess pretty well how to bring the particles back together again to annihilate without any particle traveling a long distance relative to the size of the sample. Traveling a long distance, that would correspond to a logical error, like a string operator going across the sample. But as the system grows larger and larger, the likelihood of such an error, if the noise is sufficiently weak, gets exponentially small. And that means that we have a threshold of accuracy. Once the noise is weak enough, this becomes a very good quantum memory with the probability of error, which decays exponentially as the system size grows. But so far, that's just quantum memory. We also want to be able to do processing in a reliable way. But we can use topological ideas to do that as well. We can think of this two-dimensional system as having two kinds of holes, which can be the location of either a magnetic or an electric charge. And we can imagine deforming the code in a sequence of steps, deforming by having some additional qubits join the code and other ones leave it, so that the holes can move relative to one another. And say a magnetic charge can, in a series of steps, wind around an electric charge. There'd be a Z2, a Harnoff Bohm phase, and that would be a kind of encoded operation in a certain basis. It's really a controlled NOT gate, which would be highly reliable if the noise is weak enough. And just from that controlled NOT gate, using the state distillation and gate teleportation tricks, we can build the rest of the ingredients of a reliable fault-tolerant quantum computation. In fact, one can argue that if we have an individual noise model, the qubits are getting hit by the noise, or two-qubit gates can fail independently with a rate a little bit below 1%, then we're in the sweet regime where, as the system gets large, the holes get larger and the distances between the holes get larger, we can suppress errors exponentially in system size. Okay? So here, topological ideas have inspired a scheme that we could use for any garden variety qubit, and maybe will someday, to make quantum computation scalable. So another thing I wanted to talk about is other types of protected devices. Aside from the more familiar case of storing quantum information using non-abelian anions in two-dimensional media or maybe in quantum wires, there are other ways of physically protecting information from damage. One way of doing that is the zero pi qubit that was described by Yaffe and collaborators and later by Kitaev in a superconducting device. The zero pi qubit is some device in this blue box with two leads. The superconducting phase difference between the two leads is theta. But it's designed so that the potential energy of the device as a function of theta is, to good accuracy, periodic not with period 2 pi, but with period pi. And so the potential describing the energy as a function of theta has two minima, let's say at 0 and pi, and we can think of two states that are well localized, near 0 and near pi, as the basis states of a qubit. And bit flips can be highly suppressed if there's a big barrier between those two minima. Well, we want more than that because we want to protect against dephasing. We would like the degeneracy of the two states to be very stable when we introduce local perturbations in the system. How can we get that kind of stability? Well, one way to do it is to imagine building this device out of many smaller devices, each of which favors a phase difference across its leads, which can be either 0 or pi. And then the information that distinguishes the encoded 0 and the encoded 1 is really a global property telling us whether the number of phase jumps by pi along the whole chain is an even or odd multiple of pi. Okay? So that global information, if there are big phase fluctuations along the chain, is locally nearly invisible. If we look at the chain locally, we see almost the same thing if it's a 0 or a 1, and correspondingly, the local perturbations break the degeneracy between the two states only in some high order of perturbation theory that's sensitive to the global information, and that becomes highly suppressed when the chain gets long. But again, so far this is just a memory. We don't have a way of doing protected gates. There's a way of doing protected gates as well, which was suggested by Kataev and which we've been studying further. Well, like in the earlier story, there are only certain gates we have to be able to do, and what we can do well is a rotation of a single qubit about the z-axis by 90 degrees and a certain two-qubit phase gate, which is similar to a controlled knot gate. And the way we do it is by coupling this qubit to a harmonic oscillator, turning the coupling on and off. The harmonic oscillator has to have a very large inductance. The square root of L over C is large in units set by the quantum of conductance. And then we do the gate by coupling together the LC circuit and this zero pi qubit for some prescribed amount of time, and then we open the switch and turn off the coupling. The timing of that pulse is chosen so that we do close to a 90 degree rotation in the case of a single qubit coupled to the circuit. But we might have the timing of the pulse not exactly right, so the relative phase of a 0 and 1 that's acquired during the process won't be exactly 90 degrees. But it turns out that if the timing of the pulse is wrong, the phase is very stable when it's close to 90 degrees, so a fairly big pulse error results in only a very small error in the gate. So why does that work? It works because of another older idea about how to physically protect quantum information in the state of a harmonic oscillator. So the reason we wanted this inductance to be very large is that we want the initial state of the oscillator to have very large fluctuations in the phase for it to have a wave function which is broad compared to 2 pi. Okay? And then when we turn on the coupling, we can think of the coupling as an adjustable Josephson coupling between the qubit and the circuit. And so that's a periodic potential with period 2 pi. But it's displaced or not depending on whether the phase difference across the qubit is 0 or pi. So there are two possible periodic potentials that the oscillator sees depending on the state of the qubit. And if we turn on the coupling obeying some adiabaticity conditions, the initial broad state of the oscillator becomes this grid state, narrow peaks which are widely separated from one another, and it'll either be the grid state shown or one which is shifted by half of the distance between the peaks, depending on whether the state of the qubit is a 0 or a 1. So these states have nice error correcting properties. It's easy to distinguish the encoded 0 from the encoded 1 because the peaks don't overlap. But what makes these states very nice is that if we consider Fourier transforming them and looking at the wave function in charge space instead of in phi space, we see a similar picture, again a Gaussian grid state. And that means in the dual space as well, the states are well protected against shifts, now in charge instead of in phase, which are the phase errors. Okay? Now, when we turn on the coupling, these states, well, the code space starts to evolve, it starts to rotate, and eventually we come back to the original code space. When we do, though, we come back with a twist, with some non-trivial Berry phase, and that's this 90-degree logical rotation that I've been talking about. And if we keep the switch closed a little bit too long, or we don't leave it open long enough, there will be some small error in the final state, but it'll be a correctable error, correctable using this error-correcting code in the oscillator. And so when we open the switch, we actually get the right gate with high accuracy. So we can simulate this type of thing, taking into account only the errors introduced by the mistiming of the gate, and just to make sure that The concept is sound considering a very large inductance, and see that we can get a very high gate accuracy, say better than a 1 part in 10 to the 9, even though the error in the timing of the pulse is a few percent. Okay. And actually this curve is in accord with expectations based on analytic calculations concerning how likely a logical error is when the information is encoded in the oscillator. So getting this very large inductance, that's quite challenging as an engineering problem in a superconducting circuit. I don't know if it'll ever be feasible. But it's an example, and it's important to continue to investigate physical ways in which we can protect quantum information which allow us to process it in a robust way. And the last thing I want to talk about is the search for self-correcting quantum memory. By self-correcting, I mean a quantum memory which will remain stable without any active error correction. It just stays in thermal equilibrium at some temperature, but where the protection against a logical error gets better and better as the system size continues to increase. Now, to illustrate the idea, let's consider its classical version, classical self-correction. I can imagine trying to store a classical bit in a ferromagnet in the state where the spins are all up, all zero, or all one. And if I consider it a one-dimensional ferromagnet, a one-dimensionalizing model, which I guess in the spirit of this morning's talks is the Ising model of Ising models, we introduce some energetic cost when the zero and the one misalign, when neighboring spins misalign. But if we put the system in contact with a reservoir at some temperature, thermal fluctuation can cause droplets of flipped spins. And once they appear, there's nothing to prevent the droplets from growing because the energetic cost of a droplet is independent of its size. And eventually, the droplets will grow and coalesce and lead to a logical error. So that's not a self-correcting system. But if I consider the two-dimensional version of a ferromagnet as a classical memory, now again, thermal fluctuations can introduce droplets of flipped spins, but the energy cost of a droplet increases with the size of the droplet, like the length of its boundary. So at a small but non-zero temperature, the droplets will be unlikely to grow large. And that means, since it takes a large droplet to lead to a logical error, that we can make the memory time, the time we can store classical information, grow exponentially with the size of the system at a fixed temperature. So what we'd like to be able to do is the same thing with a quantum memory. Have the protection against errors improve with system size. Well, in the case of a topologically ordered two-dimensional system, it doesn't quite work. At some non-zero temperature, the rate at which errors produce pairs of anions might be very small if the temperature is small compared to the gap, but it's number independent of system size. So particles will be produced at some rate, and once they're produced, there's nothing to prevent them from diffusing far apart from one another. And once they've diffused a distance comparable to the distance between pairs, logical errors result. And so the time that we can store quantum information doesn't grow as the system size gets bigger. So the question is, can we do better? Can we have a self-correcting quantum memory? We've actually known for a while that if we're willing to go to a four-dimensional system, we can. There are four-dimensional topologically ordered systems, including the topological code corresponding to the toric code in four dimensions, for which the excitations produced by errors are actually string-like. And again, in order for a logical error to occur, there has to be a big droplet of errors, but the energy cost of the droplet can grow linearly with its size, grow like the size of its boundary. So like in the two-dimensionalizing model, we can suppress the large droplets, which can lead to logical errors in the four-dimensional toric code. Can we do it in less than four dimensions? If we consider the three-dimensional toric code and other topologically ordered systems, we can have string operators, but typically there are point-like operators as well. So we can store classical information in these systems, and they're kind of interesting as classical memories because, unlike a ferromagnet, a global magnetic field that's small won't destabilize the memory because it's topologically ordered. But we can't protect against dephasing as well, because the dephasing errors can occur as they do in the two-dimensional toric code, because pairs of particles are produced which then diffuse apart. But an interesting code was discovered recently by Zhang Wanha, a student at Caltech, which may have implications for this problem. So Ha's code is a Hamiltonian system in three dimensions on a simple cubic lattice where there are two qubits at each one of the sides. And the Hamiltonian is a sum of commuting terms where each term acts on one of the cubes of the lattice. In this case, though, one can prove that there are no logical string operators. In other words, there are no point-like particles which can be produced and travel to opposite sides of the system in order to produce a logical error. And in fact, one can show that in order for a logical error to occur in a sequence of small steps, an energy barrier has to be surmounted, like in the two-dimensionalizing model. Though in this case, the height of the energy barrier is established not to be linearly in the system size, but logarithmic in the system size. Nevertheless, if we have some fixed temperature and we consider larger and larger systems, the protection against logical errors improves with system size. So whether a scheme like this can actually be realized in practice, I don't know. But it's important to continue to investigate whether we can build systems which can serve as good quantum memories without active error correction. And this is some progress in that direction. Okay, so I've tried to explain that there are fruitful exchanges of ideas between the topological paradigm and the conventional paradigm for doing fault-tolerant quantum computing. If we can succeed in building large-scale quantum computers in the 21st century, that'll be a great scientific and engineering achievement. Maybe we're making progress, but we certainly have a long way to go. I think we can say with confidence that however this subject develops in the future, it will owe a lot to the contributions of Michael Friedman, both as a visionary scientific leader and for his many far-reaching research contributions. So thank you, Mike. So the stabilizer, I've shown the stabilizer generators. So there are two qubits at each site. And of course, the number of cubes is a simple cubic lattice. It's the same as the number of sites. There are two commuting stabilizer generators, one of the X type and one of the Z type, acting on each one of the cubes. Okay. But there are some global relations when we put the system on a three torus. And as a result, there are logical qubits. The number of logical qubits actually depends in a complicated way on the linear size. For some choices of the size, like a power of 2 plus 1, they're just two logical qubits. For other choices, it can be as large as 2 times the linear size. Okay, so it's actually nice recreational mathematics to work out how the number of logical qubits depends on the size of the system. And in fact, although I had it on my slide, I didn't remark on it, there's a recent result by Yoshida that says if we consider a three-dimensional local stabilizer code, which is translationally invariant, that if the number of logical qubits is independent of system size, then we'll be stuck with string operators. And so there will be point-like excitations. Ha's code evades Yoshida's result because, in fact, the number of logical qubits depends in a complex way on the system size.
Wait, so this is showing that we can get self-correcting quantum memory in three dimensions as long as we're willing to make the memory exponentially large.
Well, it depends what you mean by self-correcting, I guess. I mean, what your criterion is for how quickly you want the protection to grow with system size. But as long as you're satisfied to have it be unbounded, then we can make it as large as we please, but it grows only logarithmically.
Well, right, that's why I was saying you
want to do it. Matt. Yeah, so there is a finite temperature phase transition, and it also has some interesting glassy behavior. If you try to cool it down starting from a high temperature, it equilibrates very slowly. That's related to the property that it, you know, it doesn't have point-like excitations that can easily propagate from site to site. But if you keep the temperature low, and you can see, so Ha's done the following type of simulation. You introduce a small non-zero temperature and you evolve the system, you know, with a Metropolis algorithm for some number of steps. And then you use an algorithm to try to anneal the system back to the ground state and then check whether there's a logical error. Then if the temperature is low, the probability of a logical error is, you know, quite small. And gets better as the system. Well, actually, the evidence that it grows, that it improves with system size, the numerical evidence for that is not yet convincing.